Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and heritage. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Time for Lunch is a new podcast from HRN for curious young eaters, where we focus on the serious questions.
Aren't chickens tiny dinosaurs?
We get to know our favorite foods in unexpected ways.
We just like cheered like you would cheer for your classmate when they're rounding second base in softball. And we just like, peach, 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 peach. Yay, thank you, peaches.
Learn some new recipes and jokes.
What does a boxer's mom put in his lunch? A knuckle sandwich.
And load up on fun facts.
Experts estimate that there are between 1 and 2,000 types of insects eaten around the world.
So roll up your sleeves and dig in. Subscribe to Time for Lunch on your favorite podcast app so that you and your favorite young eater can catch up on the whole first season. New episodes of season 2 out each week.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, and this is Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So today's episode is about a fascinating book that delves deep into this topic that, you know, I've kind of been casually interested in for many years. So this would be cellular agriculture, which is otherwise known as, perhaps less appetizingly, lab-grown meat or cell-cultured meat, or perhaps a little bit more appetizingly as clean meat. So let's just say it's gone through a few different marketing evolutions to speak nothing yet of the science. But it's a topic that, you know, maybe you've heard about years ago and we're like, huh. And maybe you're thinking now like, yeah, whatever happened to that? And when are we going to be seeing it in the supermarket, you know, alongside the other kind of alternative meat products that are making a big splash all over the news? So my guest today has had a front row seat to all the action and high stakes drama of this burgeoning business. And he shares it all in his new book called Billion Dollar Burger, which just came out last month. He is a reporter for Quartz, formerly also at Politico, and he has been covering the business and technology of food for quite some time. Also, he is one of the few people to have really tasted cellular agriculture-created meat so far. So, really, really pleased to welcome to the program, Chase Purdy.
Hi.
Hey. Thanks so much for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And where in the world are you right now, Chase?
I am cloistered up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Okay. So, not too far from here. So, enjoying the hot, hot summer right
now. Yeah, maybe 98 degrees today.
Yay! Oh, man. But congratulations. This is your first book, right?
Yes. First book.
And, we were just saying that it's a crazy time for books to come out, but I hope that you've been enjoying the launch for what it's worth so far.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I mean, honestly, the writing and reporting was really fun, but I have to say, like, every time that I do sort of have the opportunity to talk to people about it, the questions never end, and they're all very, very interesting. I think because everyone has such a personal relationship with food, they are, you know, they immediately have like lots of questions in their mind because this will ultimately be something that we have to think about putting in our mouths. So of course we have questions.
Yeah. I mean, I love that your book, it's like, it's very, very breezy. Like you can turn the pages. It feels like a, like an action like novel. It's like it's really entertaining. But towards the end, and I'm just skipping ahead right now, I love how you talk about how, you know, your attitude on meat and, you know, your thoughts on cooking have kind of changed in the course of reporting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think that for me, I had, you know, really developed, I mean, I guess this just really dives into the personal really quickly, but, you know, I came out of the closet, moved to Washington, D.C., to start working at Politico, and kind of dove into throwing dinner parties as a way of building community for myself. Mm-hmm. And these were very often like very queer heavy dinner parties. And so cooking and using food to sort of express myself and to create this community became a major thing. And they started happening weekly. And at that time, like meat was very much on the menu. Mm-hmm. It's such a great vehicle for seasoning and, you know, for a long time, I think, and even still today, obviously meat, especially in America, is like the sort of star player on the dinner plate. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, and I think along with lots of other people, like environmental concerns around meat production kind of, you know, really created a lot of ethical questions around whether or not I should be eating meat as much as I had been. And that kind of, I got myself into this sort of mental lurch where I didn't know whether or not, like, I could even make dinner party meals with meat or without meat.
Okay.
You know, who I wasn't equipped to be like marching vegetables onto dinner guest plates. And I kind of felt a little bit lost. And this was around the same time that I started reporting on cellular agriculture for the first time. And so that kind of played into like the reporting as I, you know, moved ahead in my career covering food. At the same time, I was increasingly having conversations with friends who, you know, it was actually just three couples, but they're close enough that they really left an imprint on me. And they were starting to question whether or not, and including, you know, a few couples said, like, we're not going to have children because we don't think that it's ethical to bring kids into this world that's going to be so shaped by climate change. So I had this, like, weird confluence of, like, my own personal, like, approach to, like, not knowing what to do with my food from an ethical point of view. I had friends who were, like, choosing not to maybe have children because of, like, an ethical point of view. It all kind of centered around, you know, climate. And those sort of crashed into the reporting. And that's kind of, I think, you know, at the very base level, that kind of is at the bedrock of what this book is based off of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, these are all choices that we make when we decide to have dinner or lunch or whatever. So I love that you shared that. And I love how the beginning, the sort of first chapter of your book, you really drop a lot of facts. So, I mean, for anyone who kind of wasn't, you know, clued into, you know, never been a vegan, you know, never really kind of considered too much, although it's kind of hard to not hear, like, you know, meatless Mondays and like these trends of like eat less meat.
Sure.
I love how you just, you know, have a lot of facts that are really striking. So, you know, there's the inherent wastefulness, you write, of animal agriculture, where it takes, let's see, about 6 pounds of animal feed to produce 1 pound of beef, or 3.5 pounds of feed for 1 pound of pork, or 2 pounds for a single pound of chicken. And, you know, that's just, speaks to, you know, the inherent resources that go into producing meat when you could be feeding people with that, you know, feed.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I mean, it's still interesting. And by the way, you said you introduced the facts so quickly. If I remember correctly, that might even just be on page 7, sort of like setting the stage for to understand.
Yeah.
But, you know, I might be jumping to conclusions here, but I've never really thought about, until working on this book, like, just the basic principle of, like, growing something to cycle it through something to get something. And whenever you start to realize, like, oh, wow, like, we're using all these resources, both energy and water and land and time, to pump lots of stuff through an organism to get less protein. And it's, you know, it's a different kind of protein, but it's right, it is interesting. And it does, I think, kind of illustrate pretty quickly that this is kind of wasteful. I think that that's kind of also, you know, it, and I think it sort of sets up a stake pretty early on, like, we should be thinking about this.
Right. Yes. Yes. I love that. And you know, hence, you know, you jump into, you set the stage in 2013. So, and this is when you first tried, actually, no, wait, this is when a big sort of, a big tasting was a public tasting of cellular agriculture produced right. meat, what you report on, took place.
Yeah.
Tell us, yeah.
Yeah, sort of like a global moment. I mean, NPR reported on it, New York Times, all these like major media outlets. But 2013 is really the year that cell-cultured meat, lab-grown meat, whatever you want to call it. I use cell-cultured because I feel like mm-hmm. it's sort of scientific and straightforward. But it's the year, 2013 was the year that this kind of splashed into the global scene. It became something that was more part of, it like introduced this concept to the public imagination. And it's when this Dutch scientist, Dr. Mark Post, who runs his own company now called Mosa Meat, but at the time he was a University of Maastricht professor. He went to London with his team, and they, on a stage that was, you know, recorded on video, media there, tasted the world's sort of first cell-cultured beef patty, which was just kind of beef. It's like basically muscle from a cow that had been painstakingly pieced together. It cost about, that single patty, about $330,000 at that point in time. And they tasted it. And that's sort of the moment that sort of the world got its first look at something that might be possible someday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Mosa Meat, that's where Mark Post is right now. And you notice, you mentioned later on that it is run by, you know, this company is run mostly by meat eaters. Mark Post himself is not a vegan, but he's doing this out of concern for food security.
Right, right. You know, especially when you start looking at the companies that are outside of the United States, the interest in growing cell cultured meat has much more to do with food security and environmental mm-hmm. concerns, which are sort of interlinked. When you look closely at the American cell cultured meat companies and cell cultured fish companies, a lot of those sort of popped up out of the vegan movement.
Right.
They're very much, you know, the one that's featured most heavily and prominently in the book, it's a company called Just. It's formerly known as Hampton Creek. That, you know, the CEO of that company, Josh Tetrick, who's sort of the primary character and vehicle in this book, he sort of professes outright, like, I'm in this for animal welfare. I'm glad that it mm-hmm. has other applications, but I'm here to try to put a massive dent in the 65 billion land animals that we kill every year to eat meat, and the, you know, 1 to 2 trillion fish that we kill every year to eat fish.
Mm-hmm. So different philosophies, but they're both fighting, or they're both, many companies are fighting towards this, a similar outcome, which is cell, wait, how do you call it again?
Cell-cultured meat.
Cell-cultured. I keep wanting to say cellular. Cell-cultured meat. Yeah, so, and your book, it ends at the end of 2019. You know, I love how you center Josh Tetrick as like the sort of protagonist of this book, because he's a really interesting character. But I mean, I guess we can all, you know that it's 2020 right now, and
yeah.
Just Foods, formerly known as Hampton Creek, you know, I haven't seen a big press release about their product yet, although at the end of your book, he was very much hoping for it to be out. I mean, even in 2018. So
right. So the background story mm-hmm. that's not, well, you know, it is kind of mentioned in the book, but, you know, sort of the behind the scenes aspect of this was, you know, Josh felt extremely confident that cell cultured meat, let's just say cultured meat from here on, because it's probably the easiest term, but like that cultured meat made by his company would be on the market somewhere in the world by the end, I think, of by the beginning of 2018. And so when I started my reporting, it was really working up to this moment that we were sort of anticipating. Uh-huh. And then that date kind of came and went. And so we kept going, hoping that, like, okay, maybe it'll come out in the next year. And by 2019, it still hadn't made it out. And then what really sort of surfaced was that this isn't really about the science and technology of making sort of a basic cell-cultured meat product. This is more what's stopping cultured meat from getting out into the world has everything to do with sort of the regulatory bodies in different countries, sort of the USDAs or FDAs around the world, sort of giving the makers of cultured meat the green light to go forward. Obviously, there's lots of red tape in the regulatory world, and the companies that are in this space are all kind of trying to navigate that. As soon as a green light happens somewhere in the world, and it will probably be either Singapore or the United Arab Emirates or Israel, maybe the US, potentially Russia. As soon as that green light is sort of lit, you're going to see basic cultured meat products going out. When I say basic, I mean kind of like chicken nuggets, chicken tenders, mm-hmm. maybe like a hot dog or something, meatballs, things that you can imagine as being ground meat products, because those are the easiest kind to grow.
Yeah. Well, I actually heard about KFC developing lab-grown chicken, speak of the devil, chicken nuggets, I think?
So KFC has partnered with a company that KFC's Russia division has partnered with a company that is based in Moscow, has a couple of U.S. outposts as well. It's called 3D Bioprinting Solutions, a really sexy food name. They do lots of different things.
Bioprinting food sounds really appetizing.
Yes, it does. And so what they're doing is KFC is partnering with this company to sort of develop a hybrid product, which is going to be sort of a plant-based mixed with cultured meat product, which is actually probably what we'll all see first. It's like creating a 100% cultured meat product is great. Okay. But the reality is that we will probably see like a mix of like that Beyond Meat plus some cultured meat because, you know, sort of about the plant-based products that are out there, a lot of them can mimic that sort of texture of meat in a lot of ways, but the taste isn't quite on point.
Oh, I see. So I think something to kind of pull it over the
You think it's sort of like
line.
Yeah, definitely. This is sort of like a, if you take a, think of it as like a staircase to like the final goal. Mm. The next step up is like this hybrid product, and then we'll probably have like the full 100% culture. But anyways, KFC Russia is partnering with this company that's also in Russia to develop this hybrid chicken nugget. And they're hoping that that product would be out in the next like year or so. They're hoping to get their sort of final prototype finished and ready for testing in the next couple of months. So it's exciting news. It definitely was a splash in the last couple of weeks on this whole cultured meat world because you don't really think of like any companies in Russia as being at the forefront. But here we have, you know, one that's really joined the pack of companies that may be getting this out first.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, there's so much. It brings to mind to me the Taco Bell meat that's like half soy crumbles and half meat.
Exactly.
So funny. We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, though, and we'll be right back to wrap up the interview.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and heritage. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of small farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for being the number one importer of Swiss Gruyere in the United States, in addition to many other specialty cheeses, including premium Kaltbach cave-age cheeses, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Okay, we're back chatting with Chase Purdy. He's the author of Billion Dollar Burger, in Inside Big Tech's Race for the Future of Food. A lot of high stakes here. So Chase, we were just talking about some recent developments in the world of fast food. But just to back up a little bit, can you tell us why you decided to focus on Josh Tetrick and the Just Foods, his company? It's a San Francisco startup, vegan food company. Folks might remember actually the big news stories back in the day of, yeah, I think 2014, when Just Mayo was launched and they got sued by Unilever. You can just maybe reiterate that why focus this book on them?
Right. So there are over 30 companies around the world in this space, each of them unique in their own particular way. And, you know, the focus on Tetrick for me was like a natural choice because, you know, I mean, to put it extremely bluntly, like of all the companies and all their different unique things that make them, that put them in an enviable spot to finish this first, Josh is the only CEO, Just is the only company that is actually already a food company. So they have sort of relationships built in the supply chains. They have a product out on shelves. Mm-hmm. They know how to work with the FDA. And so
they have a vegan brand.
Yeah, that's a big plus for them. And so, you know, if any company was going to win the edible space race to get cultured meat out, Just would certainly be one that would have a fighting chance of doing that. Josh also has if you read business news and food business news, then you're most likely familiar with Josh Tetrick. He did sort of famously several years back go up against, when he was a much smaller company, he went up against Unilever. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the reasons why his company has really succeeded is because it kind of gotten this David versus Goliath fight with Unilever and won. And then, you know, he's also running one of the first Silicon Valley unicorns, food technology unicorns, which means, you know, the company was valued at over $1 billion. So he's been in the news. He's an interesting character. He has sort of his company has certain strengths that make it, you know, a front runner in this space. And in my eyes, Josh was always like very kind of flawed. And I think that hopefully comes out in the story, because he's not sort of this natural business leader that you would maybe expect coming out of Silicon Valley or being in the food world. I mean, he has this background of not knowing. He's very human in a lot of ways. Like, he hasn't known his whole life what he wants to do. He, in fact, is, you know, kind of grew up being pulled in multiple directions. He went to law school, found out it wasn't really for him. He actually worked for a pretty prestigious law firm briefly in Virginia and just absolutely did not work out for him there. He got fired from that job. He worked in nonprofit world in different countries in Africa. He's sort of partnered on UN projects in Africa. Didn't really find a lot of satisfaction in those roles. He's been sort of a lost sort of person for a while, and that really interested me, because I think that, you know, for a lot of people, it's kind of tough to, like, know what you want to do when you grow up, even when you're already grown up. And he sort of embodies that sort of narrative as well. And I really, that sort of drew me to him, because he's just not a straightforward person. He's not a straightforward person in the sense that he is a clear story you can tell. Like, except for some people, it's like, I've always been interested in science. I went to school and was interested in science, and I grew up, and now I'm working in science, growing cultured meat. That's not his story. And that was interesting. I found it compelling.
Yeah, I love how you portray the human side of this really well in this book. I mean, if this is like the beginning stages of literally the future of food, right? This is like, this is like science fiction in play at its early chapters. You know, it is really interesting to see that these folks didn't, you know, kind of stumbled into this field.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and out of some, you know, passion and various reasons, actually. But a little bit about the godfather, Dutch godfather of this particular science that made cellular cell cultured meat possible. What was his deal?
So I actually, this may be my favorite aspect of the reporting, was that, you know, when you think of cultured meat, you might think very science fiction-y things. I mean, Margaret Atwood wrote about it in Oryx and Crake. It's appeared in Gibson's sort of The Neuromancer. It's, you know, there are lots of cases. Winston Churchill wrote about it a long time ago even. But it actually isn't necessarily the stuff of science fiction. It was an idea that really was pushed to the forefront by this Dutch man who grew up in Indonesia, which was at the time a Dutch colony. His name is Willem van Eelen. And he, you know, the long story short of him is that he was during World War II, he was captured by the Japanese and he was in a prisoner of war camp. Mm-hmm. And when he was in, you know, a prisoner of war camp and being touted across the Indonesian islands by Japanese forces, he witnessed a lot of, you know, the horrors of starvation. He sort of watched the people he was with go mad from starvation. And whenever World War II ended, when he was rescued, he went back to the Netherlands and he went to medical school. And while there, he was going through different rooms, and as his daughter tells the story, Willem van Eelen's now passed away, but as his daughter tells the story, he walked by a room and was watching cultured meat being grown for medical purposes. You know, you can use this for skin regeneration for burn victims and things like that. And people were marveling at sort of how this worked in that room, and he basically thought, like, yeah, but can you eat it? And he immediately connected culturing cells to growing meat as a way of, like, stopping global hunger. And he spent the rest of his life sometimes, you know, being very, very upset at how slowly it took to get this stuff kind of off the ground. But he spent the rest of his life really, really pushing to make cultured meat a thing. He actually put together the first consortium of researchers and scientists to make this a reality. And sort of in that consortium was Mark Post, who we spoke about earlier as the Dutch scientist to really introduce this in London. And yeah, so Willem van Eelen, you know, worked his whole life to get this out. And now his daughter, Ira van Eelen, has kind of picked up the mantle and she's working to do the same thing. And luckily she's able to see these products and taste these products, and it's at a different stage for her. But she's really very adamantly pushing this as well. So it's a family affair for the van Eelens.
I love that. And I love that you've run around the country meeting all these people and collecting their stories for this book.
It was very privileged to be able to go to the Netherlands and to Israel and to across the U.S. several times to, like, talk to all these people, to look at their laboratories, to taste some of the meat, to get an idea of the brains and the cool, you know, imaginations of the people who are actually trying to make this real.
It's something you take for granted now that we're not traveling, right?
Yeah, yes. True.
I'm glad you did this book when, you know, when you did.
Yeah.
What do you hope folks take away from this book, aside from a very exciting read?
You know, I think what I really hope is that this gives people the language that they need to be able to talk about this product with their friends and their family. I hope that it gives them, I think that cell-cultured meat offers some potentially amazing tools to combat climate change and animal welfare issues and to tackle some of the systemic issues in our current meat system that have been exposed by COVID-19. I mean, think about 35,000 plus meat packing workers are sick and right now, and that's, like, it's a very serious issue that affects actually mostly people of color. 87, I think, percent of those people in meatpacking plants are people of color who have been impacted are people of color. This technology is something to really maybe reshape how we approach meat. And while it is so optimistic and while it is so promising, it still does present a lot of ethical and interesting hurdles. It challenges the way that we think about how we eat, and we should be questioning these companies at every step, because as aphoristic as they are about all the benefits, you know, eating cultured meat isn't something we can sort of really wrap our heads around very easily. And so I hope that the book offers us all the tools to be skeptical, be thoughtful, and to have real conversations with each other about how we feel about this. Maybe it sort of gives like that first sort of, I hope it just sort of gives the vocabulary to really jumpstart some of those conversations, because we should be having them.
Thank you so much for doing that. I think that it's a wonderful book, and I just remembered, you know, a lot of people's first reactions to this industry is ew, right? That's the ew factor.
You know, I don't actually know about that. I think for some people, some people that's true. What I found in my reporting, which was, you know, I thought the same thing when I first started, but people are actually, in my experience, of course, it's all anecdotal, they're actually really curious about it. Even my grandmother, you know, who I talked to, you know, one of the interesting things, the earliest interview I did for this book was actually, I was talking to my grandma on the phone, my Nana, and I was just kind of like, you know, working on this book about cell cultured meat, what do you think, or beef and meat, whatever, what do you think? And the idea of cultured meat didn't really faze her. The first thing she jumped to, she was like, you know, I stopped buying beef, ground beef at the grocery store because it smells weird now. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, yeah, I just think, she's like, the way it's processed doesn't smell the way it used to. So I've started buying bison meat. And I was just like, wow, okay. So like, you're not fazed by the cultured meat thing, but you immediately talk about the issues you have with the meat that's available to you. And then in a later discussion with her, when the book was almost done, I was talking to her about cultured meat, and she's skeptical, but she said, you know, like, I'd try it. And if I think, like, if I can get my grandmother to admit to being, like, curious enough to try cultured meat, then I imagine there's a pretty big segment of people out there who will also be curious enough to try it once. And I think that that's kind of the ultimate moment for cultured meat, is, like, what will that first bite be, and how will people walk away from it? Because I bet most people are willing to try anything once, and if it's has the same taste and flavor and texture, if they think that and know that it's safe, and if it's economical or on its way to being very economical, then I think cultured meat has a good shot. I think that sort of, and that ultimately, that curiosity, I think, will overpower that sort of perceived ew factor.
So interesting. And, you know, more choices, all the power to that.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. So looks like that's about all the time we have, but thank you so much for sharing more about your book. And thank you so much for, you know, sharing this in-depth information throughout the book. I hope everyone gets their hands on Million Dollar Burger. It just came out last month from Random House. And you can check out Chase's work at Chase Party. Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. You can see work at Chase or at Chase Purdy on Twitter, chasepurdy.com. And yeah.
And you have a newsletter, right?
I do, yeah. I have a very nerdy cellular agriculture newsletter through Substack that's called Pluripotent.
And awesome.
If you want to deep dive into some very, you know, the particulars of cell ag, that's maybe a place to go.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chase. It was great having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really love reporting the book, and it's so fun to talk about the subject. I hope that people find it as interesting as I do.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Today's engineer is Amanda Wang, and thank you everyone at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.